The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Governor Larry Hogan is one of America's great governors in the Maryland state to my north when I live in Virginia. Good morning, Governor. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hey, good morning. It's great to be with you, Hugh.
The Orioles are 58-52, so are the Cleveland Guardians. I sure hope they meet in the postseason and we talk about it then.
Well, that sounds good to me. I mean, the Orioles are certainly much better than a lot of people expected, and we'll take what we can get being, over 50-50.
Yeah, I generally don't try and talk to the governor during Ravens-Browns week, but I'll talk to him right now. Governor, let's talk about Mar-a-Lago.
I don't blame you for not talking to me Ravens-Browns week.
That's pretty good. Maybe that will change. We'll see what Roger Goodell and his minions decide about Deshaun Watson. Give us your reaction, Governor, to the search at Mar-a-Lago.
Well, it was really kind of a totally unprecedented situation. And I read your piece about it, and I agreed with everything that you had to say. But, I don't want to rush the judgment. It's certainly the federal government better provide overwhelming evidence that this action was absolutely necessary. Otherwise, I think it can have the potential to undermine faith in democracy and the rule of law. And, we're so divided as a country today, dangerously divided. And Americans are starting to lose faith in our government institutions. And so I called on the Biden administration to release, at a minimum, the documents authorizing the FBI search. I understand it's a federal investigation that they can't, tell us all the details. But I think it's critically important that the American people really deserve to know all the facts. And we need, I think, to go overboard with really unprecedented transparency and accountability from these organizations. So, no man is above the law, not even the President of the United States, and everyone's innocent until proven guilty. But it seems to be an unusual situation, obviously. But I don't want to, rush the judgment without knowing the facts.
You're a center-right, moderate conservative, Governor. And so I'm hoping the liberals in my audience will hear you say this could undermine the rule of law and stop and say, why does Larry Hogan think that? I know why Hugh Hewitt thinks that, but why does Larry Hogan think this search, legally conducted pursuant to a warrant signed by a federal magistrate, why do you think this might undermine the faith in the rule of law?
Well, I think because it's the first time we've ever had a former president's house raided in this manner. And but when we don't hear any information about why this happened, you can only assume that it has the potential to be, something that was a political action. And that's certainly, I understand the people being concerned about why this happened, how it happened. And the only way we can really get to restore faith in that this is actually a legitimate action is to tell us what it's about. And how the FBI and the Justice Department and the federal judge decided that this was necessary. And if we can't get the Biden administration to release the documents, about authorizing the search, then we should get President Trump to release the documents. He has the documents about why they were doing the search.
Right. He's got a warrant. I'm not sure that he has the affidavit supporting the warrant. But, Governor, I do want to talk about allocation of Bureau resources. You have a lot of FBI agents living in your state, and they are important and valued members of our entire national fabric. They do great work. But I don't know where John Bolton lives, but the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, does. I'm worried about people in front of Justice Kavanaugh's house, including an attempted assassination of him. I'm worried about an open border. I just don't know about the allocation of resources to boxes in Donald Trump's basement that this represents.
Well, yeah, I can't argue with that. And Maryland probably has a higher percentage of FBI agents living there than any other state, I would imagine. We've got a higher percentage of federal employees than any other state. We surround the nation's capital. I just had a meeting with John Bolton last week in Annapolis. He lives in Maryland. And he does have security. I mean, I don't know all the details of these threats, but apparently it's still a concern. And we have been, both Glenn Youngkin and I, Governor of Virginia, have been pushing the Biden administration to do more at the federal level to help us. It's been state and local police trying to enforce the law, but there are federal laws protecting the Supreme Court justices, and they're really not doing it. We've gone several rounds with the Justice Department and the police to protect the Supreme Court justices, and we basically had to try to do their job, but we don't have the authority that they do over certain laws.
You know, Governor, I always try and put myself in the shoes of the person I'm arguing with to come up with the best argument they can make. And I think the best argument they can make is we have a high profile potential candidate for president, and we've got a political person with a potential criminal issue. What we did with Hillary Clinton was lay off, lay off, lay off, try and do it with kid gloves. And we got criticized for being soft on her. If we lay off, lay off, lay off, do it with kid gloves with Donald Trump, we'll be criticized by the left. So they're trying to do it different. That's the best argument I can come up with. Is that persuasive?
Well, it's pretty persuasive, and I'm not sure I disagree with that. That's why I think we need to get the, be transparent, tell us why and how they arrived at the decision, because maybe there's another explanation we don't know about. But yes, in the absence of fact and without them talking about what happened, you can only assume that it potentially, was exactly what you're saying. But the flip side, and we won't know until later. Flip side is, I really can't imagine. Maybe I'm being naive, but it's unlikely to me that, I have a great deal of respect for the people that you just mentioned that live in the state of Maryland that are FBI agents that, fight to uphold the law every day. And my dad's was a former FBI agent, my uncle and a couple of my cousins. And, I've always had admiration for the institution, and I know they've had some issues, but it's hard for me to imagine that the entire top leadership of the FBI and the entire top leadership of the Justice Department and a federal judge all thought it was a good idea to do this for a political statement. That's why I've been pushing to try to get more information. I never try to jump to conclusions without having data, and I don't know the facts, but it's certainly very, very concerning, and it has inflamed the country.
And, it has, and I could literally do every minute of every show, but I've got to talk about other things with you, because this matters to me as well. The IRS is getting 87,000 new employees, most of whom will be agents, over 10 years, but that's half the size of the Marine Corps. That's the Democrats' answer to inflation. What do you think about that, Governor?
Well, first of all, I'd rather have 87,000 more Marines than IRS agents.
Yes.
For sure. It's outrageous. And, even just saying you're going to grow any bureaucracy in the federal government by 87,000 people is something that sounds absurd, because we continue to have federal government growing out of control. But when you talk about 87,000 people that are going to be potentially, coming after average taxpayers, that's very, very concerning.
And that is what I don't know what they're going to run on. I really don't. Inflation, recession, crime soaring in places like Baltimore. And you know that it's not just Baltimore, it's suburbs as well. We've got, and I'm going to talk about education next. What are Democrats going to run on, Governor?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I don't think they do have much to run on. And I think they failed. And Joe Biden's been a terrible president. The Democrats are in control of everything. All of those problems can be pinned directly to them. It should be a huge Republican year as long as we don't blow it. And so we've got to keep I don't want to take anything for granted. Sometimes we get a little complacent. We're going to have to fight to win these races. So we've got to focus on our message. And our message should be focused on the economy and on crime and on education and all the things that you just mentioned, not just pointing fingers about how they failed, but what we're going to do about it and why Republicans are better. And so I think we need to stay focused on the issues people care about. We've got to be able to convince not just the base of our party, but we've got to be able to convince independents and even some discerning Democrats that we have the better ideas and we can do a better job of governing. And that's how you win elections. And that's, successful politics is about addition and multiplication. We've lost too many races. I'm tired of losing. We lost the White House, the Senate, the House. We've lost governor's seats and state legislative bodies. I think it's about time we figure out how to continue to go back to winning.
You know, Richard Nixon famously remarked during the 1968 campaign about the Goldwater supporters that he couldn't win without them, but he couldn't win with just them. And that is what you just said, addition and multiplication.
That's exactly where we are. And look, we have to, and I did this, by the way, in Maryland, in the bluest state in America, a state that Trump lost by 33 points. I ran 45 points ahead of him. It's much tougher than California. And, you know, I won the exact same vote among base Republicans and self-described conservatives as Donald Trump did. But I also added to that by winning Asians and Hispanics and the suburban women vote, and by getting 35% of the black vote in a state that has one of the highest black populations, running against the president of the national NAACP. You know, we have to find a way to have a message that appeals to more people. That's what successful politics is about. Otherwise, we can just keep preaching to the choir and not be in control of anything. You know,
Yesterday, Senator Scott said to me, the Republican Party has to become the party of parents. And your predecessor, your successor as chairman of the Republican Governors Association, Doug Ducey, just passed the most extensive reform of public schools ever by making a backpack bill in Arizona available to every parent in Arizona. It's been challenged, of course, by the teachers union. Do you think we ought to put that at the heart of the Republican Party and appeal to parents taking control of their kids' education again?
I think there's no question. That's a huge issue. And that's part of the reason we were able to help get Glenn Youngkin elected to Virginia, talking about it, get parents having more of a role in their education. And Doug Ducey, who's a very good friend and a colleague, we served together in the Governors Association, Republican Governors Association, he's the chair of, and he's a darn good governor. And we just had an RGA meeting not too long ago where all the governors, you know, were praising him and applauding him for the tremendous success he had there. And I think it's a great example of what we ought to be doing in other states and what we ought to think about trying to do at the federal level.
Okay, last question, Governor. When are you going to make your decision on running for 2024? And if and whether or not you do, when should the RNC start getting the would-be nominees together for conversations?
Well, those are both good questions. You know, I am here in Iowa, about to go to the Iowa State Fair. I'm looking forward to eating a pork chop on a stick. And I'm going to be with Governor Reynolds here in a little while. I'm meeting with some police officers and firefighters. It's Heroes Day at the Iowa State Fair, and I'm going to thank them for their service. But I have said, and I really mean it, I'm not going to even talk about the future, figure out what I'm going to do until next year. I think we have to see what happens in the 2022 election first before we talk about 24. And I've got a pretty important day job I still have a job until next January as governor of Maryland, and I'm going to finish that job and run through the tape and do the best job I can. And we have plenty of time. We've got two more years till the next election.
But, you know, the RNC is setting the rules for the debates and the forums right now. And you've got two members of the Republican National Committee from Maryland. Do you want them to get the people to? I think every time we get Republicans on the same stage, the Republicans win. I really do.
Well, that's very true. I mean, we have a lot of diversity on different things, and we have different ways of coming about. But I think that the American people need to see and hear all of those different voices. I'm all about, you know, Ronald Reagan, and I was the chairman of Youth for Reagan. I'm all about building a bigger tent. And so I think it's important. The more we can get together, and the more you can hear, the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned, how many candidates can get out there and be a voice.
Governor Hogan, have a great time at the Iowa State Fair. That tells us volumes about where you'll be in 2025. But I appreciate your talking to me this morning. Larry Hogan, governor of Maryland and a friend of the program, even if he is a Ravens fan. Stay tuned, America. Elliot Ackerman is next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, American. Novelist Elliot Ackerman has been on my program before, along with his co-author, Admiral Stavridis, but his brand new book, The Fifth Act, America's End in Afghanistan, is not a novel. It's a riveting memoir and sort of reflection on the collapse in Afghanistan last year. Elliot, welcome back. It's good to talk to you. I don't hear you, Elliot, so you must have the mute on, or we've got the mute on. I do that all the time when I'm on. There you go. Can I hear you now?
Yeah, how are you?
I'm good. Elliot, you can imagine that this book impacts people very, very differently. To me, the big hammer hit is when I get to page 255 and you're talking about my friend Ed Blecksmith's son, J.P. Blecksmith. I taught J.P.'s sister in law school. Ed is a friend of mine forever. And all of a sudden, here is J.P. His patch is on my studio's West Coast deck. And it just goes to show the American military is actually very small. But if you're even on the fringes of it, you keep running into people or the remembrances of people.
Wow. I didn't know that you had that connection to the Blecksmiths. I'll do you another one, Hugh. I was in New York 2 days ago and I was running through Central Park in the morning and this guy came running towards me the opposite way and he had the J.P. Blecksmith 5K t-shirt on and I stopped him. And I started talking to him. He sort of tipped back. I said, I was in the Marines. And to prove it, I lifted up my shoulder where I have my tattoo. I said, you know, I was friends with JP. We went through training together. And, you know, this is 20 years ago now.
So, yeah, I ran that race with Ronnie Rowell, his roommate at Annapolis. And Ronnie and I became friends forever. My son-in-law was at Annapolis at the same time, didn't know JP or Ronnie. He was a couple of years ahead of him. But what you write about here is the divide in America is between those who are in your world and those who are not, civilians like me. Some civilians listen to the music and kind of hear the music, but we don't know much about it. We don't know how it's made. But this is really about a Marine's view of the collapse in Afghanistan. When I run across J.P. Blecksmith, he dies in Fallujah in 2004. Explain to the audience what that has to do with what happened last year in Afghanistan.
Well, the portion of the book where I bring up J.P. is... at the end of the book, a friend of mine, he and I had very similar careers in the military. So we both are Iraq War veterans. We're both Afghan veterans. We both served in the same special operations units. He was actually wounded three times, and the third time was the one that took him out. So he walks with a bit of a limp now. And we decided before the fall of Afghanistan that he's an Annapolis graduate, and we would take our two sons to the Air Force versus Navy football game on the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. What we didn't know was that that anniversary would be celebrated in the wake of this sort of calamitous withdrawal from Afghanistan. So the book sort of ends with us, with our two sons at this football game, and we take them into Memorial Hall at the Naval Academy, which has all of the names of the fallen Annapolis graduates in it. And we're just sort of taking our sons to the names. And one of those names is J.P. Blecksmith.
It's remarkable. Those two little boys in the back seat are asleep when you're driving back from the game. I just think it's very well told. And they are going to grow up with an intimate knowledge. And maybe they'll end up at the academy. Maybe they'll end up in the Marine Corps as an enlisted man fighting on the front line. I don't know. But I'll tell you, the Fifth Act is going to make everyone remember a year ago. You are a very successful novelist. I know you're working on the successor to 2034. Why take time out to write a book about the collapse of America in Afghanistan when you've got deadlines to meet with staff and bestsellers to sell?
You know, this wasn't a book that I thought I was going to write. Very early on in this, my editor reached out to me and said, hey, maybe we should put together sort of a small paperback book, 30,000 words, some of the essays you've written over the years about Afghanistan, because, you know, many Americans haven't been following the war too closely. And I said, well, that sounds good. You know, we quickly signed the deal to do it. And then the entire collapse of Kabul happened. And I got, along with many others, got sucked into these evacuation efforts, trying to get our Afghan allies out. And the book is called The Fifth Act because, you know, tragedies are typically told in five acts. And what happened, I believe, last summer was tragic. And it also follows the presidency. So the four presidencies that the war spans. And then the fifth act of the book is the Taliban. And it follows these five evacuation cases. But I got signed on to do this sort of very short book, and then all of these events happened. And after they occurred, I just talked to my editor. I said, you know, I think this needs to be a very different book. I think we need to tell a little bit of the story of what happened last summer. And that's what became The Fifth Act.
It's becoming well known now that, you know, the old rule of thumb is 20% of the people in an organization do 80% of the work. In this case, it's 2% of America did 98% of getting people out of Afghanistan. And I was on the fringes of that as well, because my son works for Michael Waltz, who was deeply involved. Mike Gallagher's a friend. Tom Cotton and John Noonan were involved. Tom Tillis, who I saw, was involved. And John Androzic is the guy who sent me your book originally and said, you got to read this. And he sent me Tim Kennedy's book. I don't think America knows how few people actually organized the exodus. Do you, Elliot? Do you think they have any idea what happened by non-official America to get people out who needed to get out?
No, I don't. And I think that is part and parcel with the way these wars have been organized over 20 years, which, you know, after 9/11, we decided that we were going to fight these wars with an all-volunteer military and they'd be funded through deficit spending. And the result was that the American people were anesthetized to the cost of the war. And so it's
hold it right there for a second, Elliot. We got to take the music down. I'm going to come back tomorrow and play more of my conversation with Elliot Ackerman. All of it will be on the podcast today, America. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Adam and Dwayne. I'm coming right back with Elliot Ackerman. If you want to hear the rest of it today, go get the podcast, and it will be broadcast in the first hour tomorrow. Back now with part two of my interview of Elliot Ackerman about the Fifth Act, which is organized over the four presidencies in the Taliban. As Elliot just said, it's full of moving stories. Elliot, I want to read to you page 228. This summarizes everything about the complexity of that collapse. Admiral Mullen's wife, Sherry Mullen, the admiral now retired, is trying to evacuate a family in which the father used to work at the U.S. Embassy, but progress has proven slow. If the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs is struggling to get someone flown out of Hakaya, that doesn't bode well for us. Eventually, I fell asleep. That really says it all. There was no plan. There was no way to get anyone through Abbey Gate or the Secret Gate or any other Black Gate. It was all improvised. That's after 20 years. It was an improvisation. What's that tell you about the whole effort of the war, Elliot?
Well, I think the one thing that specifically tells you was that when there wasn't any contingency plan on the part of the administration, you know, there was this bet that there would be a decent interval, that the Afghan government would hold together, and that interval would kind of get us from the last U.S. troop leaving and the collapse or endgame in Afghanistan. But when there was no decent interval and when the collapse occurred while American troops were still there, the result was the bedlam we saw last summer.
Now, have we fully, I am one of those people advocating for a select committee into just the endgame, because pretty much 90% of the political spectrum wanted out of Afghanistan. President Trump sent Mike Pompeo to Doha to negotiate with the Taliban. But I don't believe, and Trump has said on this show, he would never have executed it this way. We don't know. It's a counterfactual. Do you want to know more answers about why it happened this way, or do you want to let it recede after we firmly affix our share of responsibility on the American military, politico-industrial complex, as you call it?
Well, I think there's probably so much political capital that's going to get expended on this issue. I would like to see that political capital expended to, you know, bills like the Afghan Adjustment Act. You know, let's get the people who came here settled right. Let's make it so they can work, so they can get on a path to citizenship, so they can become good Americans. You know, let's try to keep the flame alive with the people who are still in Afghanistan or outside of Afghanistan with special immigrant visas. I was emailing yesterday with a Afghan brigadier general I used to work with who is stuck in Turkey with his family, and he has no clear way to get to the United States. And this is a person who fought in Afghanistan for longer than I ever fought in Afghanistan for a mission that was aligned with the interests of the United States. So let's do right by these people. Like, yes, would I like to hear those answers? I would like to hear those answers. Am I concerned that a commission that, you know, would look for blame might take away political capital from doing some of these things that need to get done, like settling Afghans? You know, I would be concerned. I hope that that's what, let's focus on that, because some real good could come out of that.
Can we do two things? Secretary Clinton on this program said to me rather memorably, we can hold two thoughts. And I think we can both find out what happened at the end, the collapse, and why we left so much behind and why we did not get SIVs. And because we said it would never happen again after Saigon, Elliot. I'm old enough to remember Saigon. I was in college at Saigon. I don't know if you were born yet, but you know, I remember Saigon, and we said that's never going to happen again. And then it happened again. Don't we need an autopsy?
Listen, if we can hold those two thoughts in our mind at the same time, I'm not against an autopsy. And I think when we talk about, you know, this was worse than Saigon, ironically. I mean, yes. Because it was worse. And no war has ever ended this way before. In Saigon, all of those people clamoring onto the helicopters weren't able to phone back to a whole global network. And that happened this time. And I think that's the way wars will be fought in the future. And we need to understand that. So I'm certainly not against digging for answers as to, you know, what were the sequences of decisions that led to this? You know, why were so many people in the administration not listening? I mean, there was a letter signed by more than two dozen members of Congress, bipartisan, warning about this back in May, and it went unheeded. That letter was delivered to the White House, went unheeded by the White House. So, yes, this was a complete and total collapse of American confidence. And yeah, we should understand it. But I also think we need to understand and stay focused on the Afghans who have come here and their plight, because it isn't over for them.
You know, Andrazik and I talk about this a lot because he's very involved in resettlement of Afghan refugees, but he's also been pulled into Ukraine because he's one of the good guys in the entertainment business. He'll go where the need is. And all of a sudden, we've got 10 million refugees in Ukraine. Right now, I'm busy raising money for Food for the Poor to feed these poor people. They've got 20 million refugees running around in Ukraine. And we've got Afghanistan in under utter darkness, except we know that Zawahiri's on a balcony in Kabul. I don't know, Elliot, what your recommendation would be to a political actor, left, right, or center, about how to rebalance America's attention. The Fifth Act clearly says, and I think this is my takeaway, the civilian-military divide has gotten deeper, wider, and far more difficult for the country to bridge. And at the same time, the political-industrial complex, first time I've seen that term used in the replacement of the Eisenhower-era military-industrial complex, is obstructing our ability to defend ourselves. Is that a fair summary?
Absolutely. And I think, listen, by outsourcing our wars these ways, right, by having an all-volunteer military and putting wars into the deficit, we as citizens are basically, we're allowing our politicians to do that. We're basically giving them this huge, very long leash with which to wage war with very little accountability, because politically it's easy to wage war. So is it surprising that we wind up in 20-year wars that at the end of the day don't make strategic sense? And we talk about Ukraine. I mean, the collapse in Afghanistan is the greatest, or I would say the darkest, one of the darkest hours in NATO's history. And I assure you that Putin was watching that incredible display of weakness at Hkia. And that certainly weighs in his decision about whether to act in Ukraine and the type of response he thinks he's going to get from NATO, which I would say watching Afghanistan is he probably thought he would get a very tepid and dysfunctional response from NATO. Now, I believe NATO overperformed, but can you imagine a universe where NATO stood strong in Afghanistan? I mean, this old idea of peace through strength, and you didn't wind up with the type of incursion you had or invasion you had in Ukraine, and we weren't now dealing with all of these Ukrainian refugees.
You know, the antibodies produced by the illness that was the collapse in Afghanistan have shown up in Ukraine, and now Xi is watching Ukraine, and he saw the air base that the Soviets have in the Russians have in Crimea get blown up by precision munitions provided by some NATO member, and he's seen Finland and Sweden join the alliance. Do you think that, and I don't want to sugarcoat a silver lining here to mix metaphors up. Do you think that the collapse in Afghanistan may have returned serious people's attention to the need for deterrence, Elliot Ackerman?
I certainly hope so. I hope it's causing serious people to get their minds reengaged in the calculations of, real grand strategy and geopolitics. I mean, imagine the world we would be living in right now if Putin had been able to roll roughshod through Ukraine. You know, imagine that world if Xi decided that he was in fact going to go across the Taiwan Straits and make a move on Taiwan. You know, where we are right now living on, I feel a little bit on borrowed time. We're one or two moves away from the world looking very, very different. And there's a really clear access of authoritarian regimes that are at work right now in destabilizing the post-Second World War order. And we should be concerned about that. And those regimes are, I mean, China, Russia, and Iran.
That's it. Iran is trying to kill John Bolton on our soil. Russia is involved in a war, and Xi is threatening Taiwan. Yesterday on the program, when I heard the first part of our interview, I read from John Ellis's news items that we have agreed to conduct high-altitude training with the Indians along the Himalayan border near the Chinese-India border. That is, it's not provocative, it's necessary, but it's also completely uncovered in the American press, except for very specialized military affairs. I just don't think our media, I hate to blame the media for everything. They pay no attention to the big issues, and we are obsessing on, I'll say it, 1-6 committee. I just think it's all a misallocation of resources because we're not focused on grand strategy anymore. I think the Fifth Act does. You help us bring our attention back to it. That's why I talk to Admiral Stavridis once a week, is to try and get people back on grand strategy and our American military and national security issues. But I have been fighting a losing battle for 23 years, Elliot. People don't want to talk about it.
Well, I mean, Hugh, I don't think this is, you know, I think you're probably a soldier in a larger war. You know, it's often been said that war itself is the way that Americans learn geography, that, you know, we sit here with the Pacific on one side and the Atlantic on the other, and we too often gaze at our own navel and until we just can't do it anymore. But it certainly seems as though the walls are closing in. But I also agree with you. I think our own political dysfunction and our own self-obsession is probably, of all of these national security threats, the single greatest one.
The self-obsession and the political industrial complex. People make money from political conflict in the United States and the exacerbation. It's monetized. And talk radio, people will say, is part of it. I don't think that's necessarily so. But I sure know that MSNBC, CNN, and Fox are talking about the same things from different sides of the 10% bell curve aisle every single night. It's not productive of anything good. Books are, but as Henry Kissinger said in the end of his leadership thing, we've moved from the age of literacy to the age of image, Elliot Ackerman. And we're not going to educate anyone through images. You're not going to learn anything about grand strategy on Twitter, or am I wrong?
I agree. I mean, there's no nuance on the debate. The fact that you mentioned the news cycle, there's always, if you turn on the news, there's always just one story. That in and of itself is evidence that there is no nuance. And when we talk about trying to navigate ourselves through a dangerous world, you need to understand all of the different threads. And we don't, I think, get that in the way we are consuming news and in our national conversation. And, you know, I write about in the book, the political industrial complex as an echo of the military industrial complex, because we are being incited to division as a way for people to make money. And it creates perpetual division, which is a threat to our country.
Now, I want to close by talking about Loch Ness and the ARC. I didn't know about the ARC. And I know a lot of Marines. My father-in-law is career Marine. My brother-in-law is career Marine. I know I've never heard about this course before until I read the Fifth Act. And then it shows up at the end of the book. And you connect because you've run Loch Ness with the same, not at the same time, but you've run the same course. I think that actually talks about the weave of the American military. I ran into a guy named Tim Garrison. I don't know if you, Tim, former United States attorney in Missouri, maybe the next attorney general. I ran into him at the Nixon Library. He was there at Christmas time because he was about to ship out to Afghanistan. A civilian called back his reservist to go to Afghanistan for a year, probably in 2014. And he subsequently served under Trump as the United States attorney, and he'll be the next attorney general. And they pulled him out of his wonderful suburban life to send him off to Afghanistan to serve a year as a JAG officer at Bagram. And we became friends. I'm just amazed at how thin our military is, that we have to pull people in for 7 and 8 tours, and we have to pull reservists out of 15 years of retirement. Are we spent as a ability to attract people to live the lives that we're asking them to live, Elliot?
Well, concerns, yes, but I think what concerns me too is that the military becomes sort of a separate caste in American life. That, you know, yes, like as you mentioned, we all know each other. You know, everyone in the military, we all know each other, but fewer and fewer people know us. And if you look at the history of great nations, empires, a indicator of decline is consistently when a nation or an empire starts to outsource its military and its national security. You know, the Romans outsourced it to the provinces, but we seem to be outsourcing it to this ever more rarefied segment of American society, which is often sort of based regionally or now increasingly based sort of, there are military families. And and you see the trend lines are going up. The military service, it's become a family business. And that's not healthy. I mean, the United States is healthier when we are following our tradition of citizen soldiering.
Now, I am a complete civilian, but I have a son-in-law, and a nephew on active duty. And the son just proposed to the daughter of a Army colonel. And I think what I see from the fringes is what you just referred to. the same language, the same style of living, the same habits of reading, the same kind of conversation. When I talk with General Mattis or General McChrystal, they write very different books than when I talk to Senator X or Senator Y. They've lived completely different lives. So I think Cotton and Waltz and Gallagher and, of course, Seth Moulton, there are Democrats who serve in this capacity as well. I want the Congress to be full of veterans of the long war. Do you agree with me on that?
I absolutely agree. And I think what we're seeing with the military follows a broader trend line that we see all across America, which is the atomization of our society, that, you know, we are increasingly just self-segregating into our smaller and smaller identity groups. There is a scourge of, I think, identitarianism that is going across America right now, dividing us. And it's particularly concerning that when we start dividing our military in that way, because our military plays such a crucial role in the defense of this nation and also the political life of this nation. You know, the founding fathers warned about the large standing military and what that role that can play in a democracy. And you go back, if you look at history from Caesar's Rome to Napoleon's France, when you couple a large standing military with completely dysfunctional domestic politics, and democracy does not last long in a republic.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see Sulla marching on Rome or Caesar crossing the Rubicon. I think our professional military will never be that political. But you mentioned General Milley. My friends in the Trump White House always called him a straight shooter and a complete, absolutely apolitical guy. And there's a new book out that's saying he was quite anti-Trump. You would not have known it from his conduct in the Joint Chiefs. And before him, I think Joe Dunford and Peter Pitt. I mean, we've had great chiefs of the Joint Chiefs. We've had great Army, Navy, you know, their senior leader. I don't think the political leadership's been very good, Elliot. I really don't. I think that we've fallen down on that.
I agree. And I think that we have a political class that seems very eager to politicize the U.S. military. And I think one of the reasons the U.S. military retains its position as the most trusted institution in the United States is because up to now, it hasn't been effectively politicized. And I agree with you. We have very good senior leaders in the military. But these forces of politicization, it's not necessarily only the, you know, the four-star generals that we need to be worried about. It's also how that politicization affects the ranks. And I'm not saying this as a partisan. I'm more just bringing up as, you know, if you look closely, you can see these little cracks emerging where there are majors or lieutenant colonels or others who are speaking out in inappropriate ways. And there's the concern if those people get sucked into a hyper partisan echo chamber that they could be used as tokens in a broader partisan game.
You reminded me about Stuart Scheller just now. And so I want to talk about that. It's a very important chapter in your book about what that signified. And would you explain it if you got five more minutes? I hope that I'm not taking up your time. The Fifth Act needs to be read. We've said the Fifth Act's title on both days. But Stuart Scheller came and went in the American consciousness, but he's still out there doing something. I don't know what, just like the captain of the Roosevelt is out there doing something. I don't know what. American military figures show up in controversy for about a week and then they go away and we never know what happens to them. You bring our attention back to Stuart. Tell us about what you think has happened and what happened there.
Well, you know, Stuart Scheller is actually a contemporary of mine. We served in the same infantry battalion many years ago. He was a battalion, again, to this theme, we all know each other. He was at the time a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, you know, by all indications, a successful career. And after the fall, after the Abbey Gate bombing, sort of in a moment of just disgust, recorded a, you know, just a very, you know, very upset Facebook post about the failures of that he saw up and down in the chain of command from the president down to the commandant of the Marine Corps. And he was demanding accountability, which I'm sure to many of your listeners would seem, you know, would be sympathetic to that. I myself have demanded accountability and in those days, you know, wrote some pretty pointed opinion pieces. The difference is he's an active duty military officer and technically is not allowed to speak out publicly against his chain of command. And when I saw that he had spoken that way, you know, it was very clear he was committing career suicide, and I'm certain he knew what he was doing. And it was sort of like this an act of self-immolation. You know, he had gone and very publicly lit himself on fire. And that just gave me pause when I thought of it as this act of self-immolation because, you know, listen, if you go back to the Vietnam War and the Buddhist monks lighting themselves on fire or to Mohamed Bouazizi in the Arab Spring, he was that Tunisian fruit vendor who lit himself on fire. when people start lighting themselves on fire, we should pay attention. And so, you know, I can't necessarily sit here and draw a plumb line between, you know, the actions of Stuart Scheller and some imminent civil war that's going to happen in the United States with the military. But it certainly concerned me to see people I know as professionals so upset that they would commit this type of career suicide. And I think we should just all pause and recognize that, yes, we have an apolitical military, but it's not because military members don't have their own political beliefs. Of course they do. No, it's because there's a culture of omerta in the military. We don't talk about politics. It's not something you bring to work. But, you know, under enough stress, and I don't think we're there yet, but under enough stress, that code of omerta can break. And it doesn't always break. We always fixate on the four-star generals and who are our generals, who are our admirals. But listen, if we look back, it's a reason that it was, you know, Colonel Ataturk, Colonel Gaddafi. You know, when you look at these seismic things, it's typically not the generals, right? It's the young Turks. And so we should also be watching over there as we try to understand what our political dysfunction means with regards to our military. It's not just about the generals.
Elliot, I'm not in the least bit. I have never lost a minute of sleep worrying about coups in America. I don't, because I know the military, as a civilian knows the military. I have complete confidence in them. But I also know that there are, you know, you have mentioned Captain Crozier. Admiral Stabenow and I talked a lot about in his most recent book what the captain of the Roosevelt did and why he did it and why it was good. And the debate about him. I know I'm going to get emails from retired general officers. I know that about this conversation. And they're going to ask me why I didn't ask you. So I'm going to ask you. Nobody resigned from the Pentagon active duty senior leadership in the aftermath of Afghanistan. Not one general officer. What do you read into that, if anything?
Well, I think it's I think the current and I think American political life right now with regards to senior officers seems to be that the way to be most effective is not to fire off the one single bullet that is your resignation letter. It's to stay in the job and do the job the way you think the job should be done until the leadership is forced to fire you. So that seems to be kind of, you know, de rigueur behavior amongst general officers who everyone sort of knows disagree with the administration. That being said, there are also like these currents that I've been exposed to where lower ranking members of the military feeling a degree of disgust that absolutely no one has been held accountable for this. And where will the accountability come? And so no members of the administration resigned. Secretary of State, still the Secretary of State, same with the National Security Advisor, and same with the entire highest levels of the leadership at the Pentagon. And I think that is, again, you know, discouraging for the people who were there where the rubber met the road in Afghanistan last summer.
Last question, Elliot. I expect a lot of attention to the collapse, the anniversary of the collapse, which is underway now. It's not coming, what I expected. Is the Fifth Act getting the attention that an ordinary memoir would get about an anniversary that's written? I mean, you're in the middle of trying to get people out. You know the Marines, not the personal Marines who get blown up at Abbey Gate, but you know what it's like for Marines to go through that. And you know what that whole war meant because you were there. Are we paying attention or have we moved on to searches at Mar-a-Lago and the 2022 elections and no one is looking back, even though it's 1 year later?
I think it's always yes. I don't think we're really looking back in the way that we should necessarily be looking back. And people are much more interested in Mar-a-Lago and will he run or won't he run and what's going to happen. And it's difficult to make people care about what I believe is probably the most crucial decision we make in America, which is the decision to go to war and to sacrifice our young men and women on battlefields overseas. And so for whatever reason, this seems to be an issue we have a hard time caring about these days.
Elliot, I'm going to close here. I'll give you the last segment. What you said earlier, the big three, Xi is threatening Taiwan. Putin is at war in Ukraine. And Iran is trying to kill Americans on American soil. There's a complete impunity for the great power competition for our adversary. And we're not even talking about. I don't know how you get back from that ledge. In the Cold War, Time Magazine, before you were born, Time Magazine used to come out with their balance of forces stuff. If you're a sixth grader, you're reading the cover of the number of missiles they have and standing troops. You're constantly talking about great power competition. If you're 66, you grew up with it. We have an illiterate generation about great power competition. They're absolutely illiterate. Geography, learning war, as you said. I don't know how to fix that. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that as we close out our conversation about the Fifth Act America's end in Afghanistan?
Well, I think there is a lack of seriousness right now that is going on in American political life. And yes, you know, we have these, you know, we have these, this axis that we just laid out, you know, who these authoritarians who, you know, very clearly have aims on undermining the United States and our allies abroad, who are hostile to liberal democracy. And, you know, what are the debates that we're having in the United States? We're not talking about these things. We're not talking about the serious issues. You know, the barbarians are going to be at the gate, and we are going to be arguing about what gender pronouns to use for them.
Well put. Elliot, congratulations on the fifth act, America's End in Afghanistan. I hope you are back to work on what may be the only way into the American consciousness, novels. I really hope the successor to 2034 is on time and is timely, because it's the only way to get into the American imagination is via novel. It's actually the only way left. So good luck in your career on that end.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me, Hugh.
Thank you, Elliot.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.